Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Thanks for coming tonight. Before I start, I'd like to tell you about the upcoming reading for next, which is scheduled for next week, 1 week from tonight in this same room at the same time on Wednesday night, October 20th, by poet Gerald Stern. So I hope you can all come to that reading, as well as the many other things that are going on around town. Tonight we have two readers, and I'm really happy to be here to introduce them. It's a very exciting reading for me. I've been looking forward to it. I feel like I'm standing between two generations in women's poetry in America. On one side, there's Carolyn Kaiser, who is kind of an iconic figure in American letters with a long, long list of accomplishments and a wonderful career. And on the other side is Alison Joseph, a very young and very promising poet at the beginning of her career. So it's a wonderful combination. Alison will read first, and I'll introduce her now. I first met Alison Joseph in cyberspace. She and I both subscribe to a women's poetry listserv to which Alison is a prolific contributor, often the first to respond to questions or requests for help from other writers on the list, often posting information about new or changing poetry websites, including at least one of her own creation. She reminded me earlier that it's actually a web page. I don't know the difference. But at any rate, offering information about contests and advice on getting one's work published. Although we had not yet met in person, these many contributions gave me a strong impression of Alison as a smart, savvy, and very generous woman, and a very young one, too, to feel so at home out there on the web. Alison Joseph was born in London in 1967 and educated at Kenyon College and Indiana University. Her books of poetry include What Keeps Us Here, winner of the 1992 Ampersand Press Women Poets Prize and the John Zacharias First Book Prize from Plowshares and Emerson College, Soul Train from Carnegie Mellon in 1997, and In Every Seam from the University of Pittsburgh also in 1997. And her books and also Carolyn Kaiser's books will be on sale over on the table after the reading, and they will also be able to stay around and answer questions and talk. Alison will be included along with Langston Hughes, Gwendolyn Brooks, and others in an audio anthology of African-American poets forthcoming from Rhino Records. She has received awards from the Illinois Arts Council, the Breadloaf Writers Conference, the Suwannee Writers Conference. She teaches at Southern Illinois in Carbondale, where she serves as poetry editor for the Crab Orchard Review and directs a young writer's workshop for high school-aged writers. David Wojon has written about Alison Joseph's poetry that it is shorn of the easy and familiar visionary posturings in favor of a hard-bitten realism. This observation seems true to me. Like many poets of the last 30 years, Joseph has written about personal and cultural memory. In Every Seam, scans the poet's childhood and young adulthood, where we see father, mother, and first lover. But like her more distant predecessor, Elizabeth Bishop, Joseph swerves to avoid the predictable epiphany. In one poem, a preteen girl stuffs her bathing suit. I lost my mic. Is it still on? Okay. A preteen girl stuffs her bathing suit with wads of toilet paper to make herself look more busty. And the poem approaches its dramatic climax as she walks toward a sexy young lifeguard, only to accidentally fall into the swimming pool. Alison Joseph can also surprise her reader's assumptions about race and class. In Five and Dime, a sneering store manager watches for shoplifters among his tan and brown customers. We are well into the poem before we realize that the speaker herself is one of the children he hated most. Joseph hits racism head-on in other poems such as The White People Next Door and Academic Instructions, which begins, "Don't write about being black. Excuse me. All that racial jive is passé anyway. No one wants to hear how waitresses won't serve you." Alison Joseph's humor is wry, and she gives us a record of her world that is understated, clipped, and detailed, but not cluttered. Even when she revels in the sensual abundance of a fabric store, she brings the poem to rest on the minutest details, threads pulled tight in every seam, the title line for her book. I look forward to hearing more from this poet, and I'm glad she's here tonight. Please welcome Alison Joseph.
been a long, hard road getting here. And I actually do live in the state of Illinois, but I live in Carbondale, which is about 2 hours south of St. Louis. So if you ever take a trip to visit me, plan on being in the car for quite a while. I'm going to start with a few poems from Soul Train, which is named for the television show. And I've read this poem to audiences of all colors, shapes, sizes, and descriptions. And even if you've never seen the television show, I think you can recognize the longing in the speaker's voice. Soul Train. Oh, how I wanted to be a dancer those Saturday mornings in the living room, neglecting chores to gape at the whirling people on our television, the shapely and self-knowing brown-skinned women who dared stare straight at the camera, the men strong, athletically gifted as they leaped, landed in full splits. No black people I knew lived like this, dressed in sequins, makeup, men's hair slicked back like 40s gangsters, women in skin-tight, merciless spandex, daring heels higher than I could imagine walking in, much less dancing, and that dancing full of sex, swagger, life, a communal rite where everyone arched, swayed, shimmered, and shimmied, hands overhead in celebration, bodies moving to their own influences, lithe under music pumping from studio speakers beneath the neon letters that spelled out Soul Train, the hippest trip in America. I'd try to dance to keep up, moving like the figures on the screen, hoping the rhythm could hit me in that same hard way, that same mission of shake and groove, leaving my dust rag behind, ignoring the furniture and the polish to step and turn as they did, my approximation, nowhere near as clever or seductive, faking it as best I knew how, shaking my 12-year-old self as if something deep depended upon the right move, the righteous step, the insistent groove I followed, yearning to get it right, to move like those dancers, blessed by funk, touched with rhythm, confident in their motions, clothes, their spinning, and experienced bodies. After reading that poem several times at readings, I realized that it's also an ars poetica, that the things poets hope to accomplish is, you know, faking it as best they knew how, and sometimes you get it right. Sometimes you move like those dancers. This next poem, as Deborah mentioned in her introduction, and thank you very much for that very sweet and loving introduction, I write a lot about adolescence, the terrors thereof. This poem is called Junior High Dance. No one wanted to dance with us in eighth grade, to glide across the shiny expanse of gym floor, choosing us from among the awkward and shy girls, the boys loud and pushing instead, uncouth to everyone but chaperones. I had on the ugliest pantsuit, matching orange and blue, homemade by my mother before she dazzled us with cotton and corduroy. My best friend had an earache, but stayed anyway, swaying to the music, letting it carry her heavy body a little forward, away from the wall, back. The speakers didn't wail the way I wanted them to, their volume respectable, although you could hear Diana Ross singing, "I'm coming out," her anthem of disco liberation. We watched the other kids dance, lithe Hispanic girls who always seemed to know when to turn, how to bow and shimmy or smile. Watched the older black girls who, self-satisfied and worldly wise, knew all the latest steps and all the variations on the latest steps. So when I dared once before to venture on the dance floor, they hooted at me, said, "That's old," with the surety they had about nothing else. April and I hung back, sassy wallflowers joking about our teachers, their whiteness, their lack of street savvy. They still thought Diana Ross was a supreme, that she still sang, "You Can Hurry, Love," with Flo and Mary, that Motown was still Hitsville, USA. No one could convince us we had something to learn from them. No one could tell us they were anything more than old as they blew up balloons, made sure the lights stayed on. And we had our, and we had our corner, our tiny bit of that place where we listened to that garish dance music, not letting our bodies stray far, staying right there, no matter how funky the beat, no matter how delicious. I always like ending a poem with the word delicious. This next poem takes you even further into, that's junior high, but this is, I guess, elementary school in this poem. And when I went back to my neighborhood, a lot of the poems in every seam come out of my neighborhood. I was born in London, but I grew up basically in the Bronx. And I was so happy to see that even with all the violence and the way things have changed, little girls still stand around in street corners singing Miss Mary Mack and clapping their hands together. So this poem comes out of that. It's called On Sidewalks, On Street Corners, As Girls. Just who was Miss Mary Mack, all dressed in black, with her stalwart buttons up and down her back, her patient request for 50 cents to see some bedraggled circus elephant jump a fence? As children, we never asked who she was, content instead to clap out her story in pairs, our hands meeting, then parting in quick motions, when we sang, "We're going to Kentucky, we're going to the fair to see the señorita with flowers in her hair." We'd shake our little girl hips in time with the melody, but we never stopped to ask what a lovely señorita was doing at a fair. And we possessed no knowledge of where Kentucky was, didn't even know what one did at a fair. Children who only knew cinder block and cement, corner storefronts, brick high-rises. We sang about Miss Lucy and her prized steamboat, the steamboat destined for heaven and Miss Lucy for hell. Sang, rumble to the bottom, rumble to the top, one girl in the midst of the circle twirling and twirling until she stopped, finger pointed at the next girl who would shake her stuff in front of us. Our chants heard in every schoolyard, every parking lot, everywhere small, dark girls could gather to hear their voices swell in nonsense rhyme, neighborhood chant. Hands and feet would stomp out rhythms inherited from older sisters, story songs about seeing London, seeing France, sassy songs about someone's mama doing wrong, acting crazy. No one would dare take away our homemade street corner music. So we'd spend every afternoon after school and every shred of summer daylight riffing, scatting, improvising, unafraid to tell each other, shake it to the east, shake it to the west, shake it to the one you love the best. Well, that poem sort of gives you the loving side of girlhood. This is the other side of girlhood. This is called Traitor. What did that girl on the playground mean when she hissed, "You ain't black," at me? Pigtails bouncing, her hands on her bony hips. She sucked her teeth, stared at me with such contempt that I wanted to hide in my mother's skirts, wanted to scurry to my house's hall closet, safe among the great dark coats. "You talk funny," she said, "all proper," as if pronunciation was a sin, a scandal, a strike against the race only a traitor would perform, an Uncle Tom sellout. Somehow I'd let her down by not slurring. I'd failed her by not letting language laze on its own, its sound unhurried. I'd said isn't rather than ain't, called my mother mom instead of mama, pronounced th distinctly so no one would confuse them with dem, those with those. Your mama talked that funny? The girl demanded, her face in my face now, her nose inches from mine, her eyes lit by something near hate, but more ferocious, a kind of disgust mixed with pity, disdain. We're from Canada, I said, and the girl's eyes went wide as if I'd said cantaloupe or harpoon or some nonsense word like abracadabra. There must not be no black folks in Canada, then, she sneered, leaning in further, pushing on my chest with one bony finger, pinning me there like a bug to a fly screen, pressing me so hard that my lower lip started to tremble on its own, a sign of weakness she laughed a mocking, heavy laugh at, telling me, go on and cry, white girl. Cry till your mama can hear. Pushing me so I toppled onto my back, ripping the pants my mother warned me not to rip. She stood over me, laughing like she'd just seen the world's best clown, laughing though I was just as dark as she, my hair in the same nappy plaits, my skin the same rough brown. This is a poem that I wrote for my father. Now I'm confused as to which of these is mine, so I won't drink anymore. This is called My Father's Heroes, and it's one of those, hey Dion, one of those poems that name drops, but I think you'll probably know the names in the poem. My Father's Heroes. Not JFK, not MLK, certainly not Ronald Reagan or Edward I. Koch. No, my father instead chose to glory in the feats of cool Papa Bell, quickest man in the Negro Leagues, able, Dad bragged, to flick off a light switch then dart into bed before the room went dark. Praising the fast, dancing feet of the Nicholas brothers, he called my attention to their rapid-fire acrobatics, but saved his true love for Peg Leg Bates, the one-legged tap dancer who'd pound out a furious rhythm on his wooden leg, dazzling audiences with leaps, hops, bounds. I never saw Father anywhere near a piano, but he still schooled me about Jimmy Rushing, Mr. 5x5, tagged so because he stood 5 feet tall and looked 5 feet wide, had me humming Jelly Roll Morton's Creole Jazz, though he'd never been near New Orleans, made certain I knew the difference between Fats Domino and Fats Waller, played me the Harlem Rhapsodies of Ellington so loudly I thought the orchestra itself had come to visit. Sir Duke in our living room, elegant in top hat, tails. To Dad, Satch Moe and Satchel Paige both deserved equal praise. Equal adulation was given to the theatrics of Louis Jordan as he belted out rhythm and blues tunes about hard-headed women like Caldonia, the hidey-ho of Cab Calloway as he spun tales of Minnie the Moocher, Regal in yards of Zoot Suit, and to the sublime grace of Mr. B, Billy Eckstein crooning smoother than any white man. Coleman Hawkins, Lester Young, Bird and Diz all came to play from our raspy console hi-fi, its needle worn, jumping over scratches. But some mornings I'd wake to hear a woman's voice filling our room with trembling longings, a voice so vulnerable even I understood, even though the language was French, the singer, white, female. This, he'd say, is Piaf, the little sparrow. and I'd listen to that voice send its sorrows through our house, and I knew that what touched my father wasn't always race, wasn't always color. Somehow he knew I needed to hear this woman sing from her fragile bones, her sound silencing us both, as her crowds in Paris must have been, when they saw her tiny figure on the stage, bent over to sing the last vestiges of a ballad, the last words she'd give them. I'm going to read a few more poems. I write a lot of school poems. Maybe it's because I've never actually left school. And this next poem is about my actual high school Spanish teacher. All my teachers have come back to visit me in some way or another. Some good ways, some terrifying. But whenever I read this poem, people go, "That was my Spanish teacher. You had her too?" Señora Williams. Señora Williams would have liked to wrap our knuckles whenever we conveniently left our homework home, the strenuous tarea she assigned as if we had no other class but fifth period intermediate Spanish with a profesora who ranted ceaselessly when we didn't roll our R's, when we insisted on making silent H audible. Scowling, she walked the narrow rows between desks, demanding to see our verb conjugations, our primitive answers to the textbook's facile questions, snapping if we left one off. Blank spaces so repellent to her, she'd stand by our desk to punish us, firing off vocabulary drills, mocking us when we couldn't remember the most basic verbs, ser, to be, volver, to return, there to see, romper, to break. She wanted to break us, so she prodded, badgered, jumped up and down, her massive curly bouffant immobile, powder and rouge heavy on her puffy face, her frown bright in ruby lipstick. She'd single people out, make them stand to read aloud, charging forward if they refused, ready for una lucha grande every time. Once, she singled out Teresa, one too many times, trying to make her learn, forcing her answers, asking, ¿Cómo se dice dress? ¿Cómo se dice shirt? ¿Cómo se dice pants? Whacking her ruler on Teresa's desk with each question, glaring as Teresa refused to reply. Señora Williams banged that ruler three more times, harder each time, until Teresa grabbed it, broke it, yelled, ¿Cómo se dice, bitch? Her accent perfect in anger. Señora Williams screamed, ¡Get out! And Teresa slammed her book's mouth as she left the class, cheering her on silently, knowing there'd be pages and pages of homework because of this. Más verbos, más preguntas, more woman hate, more hours hating that woman who called us all perezoso, so lazy she couldn't teach us anything, not even if she died trying. And I do have this vision of her sort of exploding one day in a classroom, just going up in a big ball of lipstick and hairspray. I'm going to read two more poems. These are newer poems that aren't in any of my collections. And what I describe in the poem, this actually did happen to me when I was in high school. It references the film Birth of a Nation. And that's the title of the poem. Birth of a Nation. Our parents had to sign permission slips to let us watch the greatest movie ever made, D.W. Griffith's masterwork of close-ups, carpetbaggers, magnolia damsels, mouths open to scream their silent fear of black brutes. I sat tense at my desk, flickers of rage curling my fingers as the film reeled its images above. Negro legislators crazed for chicken, dirty bare feet up on desks as they chomped and gnawed those bones. Pale Flora jumping off a cliff to escape a black man's touch. I sat so tense, no word, no joke from my white brainiac whiz kid friend could soothe me. No lecture on historical objectivity from my shrew-faced teacher could calm the bitter at the back of my throat. At that moment in that classroom, I wanted to know no white people, to know nothing of this long dead white man who'd made an ugliness this powerful, a shame we wouldn't talk about. How that classroom grew small and hot and close. How conscious was I of my black skin, mute but not awed, like the audiences who cheered the halo Griffith made float around a Klansman's head. Where was my light, I wanted to ask. Who was going to glorify someone like me? Certainly not my teacher, who was only a woman, not a shrew, not my friend the next desk over, who was only a goofy kid, good at calculus. Who was going to build a history from one lesson of despair, one afternoon when all I could see was that hooded figure projected above, looming white and large like a savior, a saint. One last poem. This is a poem that, well, the person mentioned in the poem is my husband. And for many years, we resisted getting CD players. I say players in the plural because now we have four, I think. We thought they were a trap created by the record industry to make us buy the same albums that we already had all over again. But when we did finally break down, because people were starting to send us presents of CDs and we had no way of playing them, when we did finally break down and buy one, the first CDs my husband ran out and bought were Bob Marley's CDs, the great, late, great Jamaican reggae singer. And I thought this was the funniest thing, that my husband would just run out and get these CDs. And I wrote this poem. It's also a love poem for my husband. The title is, My Husband Plays Me Marley, and it's one of those poems where the title sort of bleeds into the first line. My husband plays me Marley, more than any white man born and bred in Arkansas should. So much that I think any day now he will wake with a head full of dreads, big spliff between his lips like Marley's on the album covers. In this age of CDs, he actually owns the albums, even the one where the cover tells you how to clean herb. Though I'm the one with the mother from Jamaica, he's the one leading me through get up, stand up, and Rastaman vibration. I guess that makes me Rita to his Bob. And I'm so glad to sing with him, to give thanks and praises to a God I wouldn't refer to otherwise. He makes me name each wailer, fills me with stories of Bunny and Peter Tosh. Bunny could sing while Peter talked his way through a song. Marvels with me at how much Ziggy looks like his dad, even if the younger Marley isn't nearly as astonishing musically. I think Bob would smile if he knew us, laughing at my husband even though he's a crazy bald head, a white man like the white captain who married Marley's 18-year-old mother, only sent money after their son was born. When my husband croons, No woman, no cry. He changes the words, sings the name of our town instead of Trench Town, and I begin to think that I could live anywhere with him, any place we can open windows, let in a pale imitation of the sun Marley knew. Nowhere we can go where Marley can't follow, singing sweet songs, melodies clear and true. This is Marley's message to us, and we are grateful this messenger once walked the earth, telling us every little thing is gonna be all right. And we listen, dance to his voice in the light of our lives. Thank you.
Thank you, Allison. She has a beautiful singing voice, doesn't she? Okay. For many poets of my generation, the name Carolyn Kaiser calls up a larger-than-life image of a mentor and leader, whereas Emily Dickinson cautioned us to tell all the truth but tell it slant. Kaiser has shaken her head in refusal, flung open the door, and told all the truth out loud just as she sees it. She is an unapologetic feminist and political activist who has occupied positions of power and influence which are often, even now, reserved for white men. And she has generously used this influence to help advance the careers of poets such as Lucille Clifton. As early as 1959, Kaiser founded the literary journal Poetry Northwest, for which she served as editor until 1965. She was the first director of the literature program for the National Endowment for the Arts from 1966 until 1970. Her teaching career includes many, many, many positions. Some of them have been at Columbia, Stanford, and the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. Last spring, amid a furor of controversy, Kaiser joined poet Maxine Cumin in protesting against the Academy of American Poets' nearly 65-year history of excluding minority writers from its board of chancellors by resigning from her own position on that board. Carolyn Kaiser's 7 books of poetry include her most recent, Harping On, published in 1996, Yin, which won the Pulitzer in 1985, and Mermaids in the Basement, published in 1984. She just told me earlier today that her first book, which I see is on the table, has been reissued by Carnegie Mellon Press, The Ungrateful Garden. As critic, editor, and translator, Kaiser has published many other works, including The Essential John Clare, Proses, Essays on Prose and Poetry, 100 Great Poems by Women, and Carrying Over, translations from Chinese, Urdu, Macedonian, Hebrew, and French African. In a literary era which, for decades, has cherished the personal lyric, Kaiser has held her own as a witty classicist. Her famous poem, Pro Femina, a satire of the misogynist ancient poet Juvenal, begins like this. From Sappho to myself, consider the fate of women. How unwomanly to discuss it, like a noose or an albatross necktie. I'm tempted to go on, quoting her lines as one might quote from Pope's Essay on Man, but I won't. Kaiser is at home in a range of subjects, mythology, motherhood, the intricacies of an interracial friendship. Harping On includes a hilariously updated translation of Canto 17 from Dante's Inferno, as well as a poem about an arduous and disastrous attempt to follow a recipe for homemade lentil soup. Carolyn Kaiser is intensely admired by the many poets who are now exploring rhyme and meter in their own work. She is an accomplished and daring formalist, having written in meters such as classical hexameter, which is rarely attempted by any poet writing in English. Harping On includes the sonnet, villanelle, pantoum, rhymed couplets, and trochaic tetrameters. Her mastery of craft gives her words all the more power to have a lasting life. Please welcome Carolyn Kaiser.
Well, I'm so happy to be back in Chicago, and I have 3 good women poet friends here, Rosalind Brown, Dear Gwen Brooks, and Liesl Mueller. Gwen and Liesl are both in Plug, 100 Great Poems by Women, which has a 500-year span. You all know, of course, Gwen's poem, We Real Cool, but I want to read a poem of Liesl's, which I love dearly, which you may not be quite as familiar with. I particularly love this poem because I've just been reading a spate of super confessional poems by ladies who conceal nothing. It's called Romantics, and it's about Johannes Brahms and Clara Schumann. The modern biographers worry how far it went, their tender friendship. They wonder just what it means when he writes he thinks of her constantly, his guardian angel, beloved friend. The modern biographers ask the rude, irrelevant question of our age, as if the event of two bodies meshing together establishes the degree of love, forgetting how softly Eros walked in the 19th century. How a hand held over long, or a gaze anchored in someone's eyes, could unseat a heart. And nuances of address not known in our egalitarian language could make the redolent air tremble and shiver with the heat of possibility. Each time I hear the intermezzi, sad and lavish in their tenderness, I imagine the two of them sitting in a garden among late-blooming roses and dark cascades of leaves, letting the landscape speak for them, leaving us nothing to overhear. This poem is called Election Day 1984. I believe the candidate then was Mr. Dukakis. Anyway, this contains the greatest first line since Milton. Did you ever see someone cold cock a blind nun? Did you ever see someone cold cock a blind nun? Well, I did. Two helpful idiots steered her across the tarmac to her plane and led her smack into the wing. She deplaned with two black eyes and a crooked wimple, bruised proof that the distinction is not simple between ineptitude and evil. Today, with the president's red button playing such a prominent role, though I can't vote for it, I wonder if evil could be safer on the whole. This next poem is to really the woman that raised me in some ways more than my mother did. Her name was Gerda. And the epigraph is in Swedish. Anybody here speak Swedish? Good. It goes, Gud som haver barnen kär, sig till mig som liten är, var jag mig I varten vander, star min lika in Guds hander. Which goes, God who loves little children, take care of this small person. Wherever I wander in the world, my fate lies in your hands. Fortune comes and goes, but you are our father forever. I think that's much more consoling than if I should die before I wake, don't you? Down the long curving walk you trudge to the street, stoop-shouldered in defeat, a cardboard suitcase in each hand. Gerda, don't leave, the child cries from the porch, waving and weeping. Her stony mother speaks again of the raise in salary denied. Gerda demands $10 more than the 25 a month she is being paid to sew, cook, keep house, dress, and undress the child. Bathe the child with the rough, scaly hands she cleans in Clorox. Sing to the child in Swedish. Teach her to pray, to count on her toes in Swedish. 40 years on, the child still knows how, is a great hit with children under 7 in Sweden. Singing a folk song, praying, counting toes. For $25 a month in 1933, Gerda makes for the child her favorite, Fatiman, a mix of flour, milk, and eggs you cut in strips, then fry in fat, then dust with sugar. The child helps Gerda cook, so she knows this. In Stockholm, the child will inquire of Fatiman, but like lost Gerda, it does not exist. Deep in the depression, the child fears for her as Gerda trudges down the walk, 4 blocks to the bus, then the train to Minneapolis. What will she do? Gerda, trained as a nurse, found no work before she came to us. $25 a month to sew a quilt for the child covered with fabulous animals feather-stitched in blue and white. Now, after 50 years, it hangs on the wall of the child's grandchild in a Chicago house. Then, when the child is awake, addled and drunk with nightmare, she dragged the quilt from her cot, stumbled, sniffling, into Gerda's room to be taken into her bed, soothed back to sleep by the rough antiseptic hands. The child wakes up to naked light. Ageless Gerda's steel-gray bob shakes into place. She owns no mirror. Blind Gerda gropes for her steel-rimmed spectacles as the child sees with fascinated love the curd in the corner of each of Gerda's eyes. It is a magic substance the child has improvised on a favorite tale, Hans Christian Andersen's Snow Queen. She thinks of it as the good cream curd, the reverse of the splinter in the eye of little Kay. Everyone like the brave child in the story. Everyone like Gerda. Modest Gerda dresses in the closet. Then the two on tiptoe steal to the child's room so the stout, handsome mother will not waken. Then Gerda bathes the child, scrubs her hard all over with the loofah, dries her carefully on the big warm towel, pulls on her panties of white cotton. Then the dress, smelling deliciously of Gerda's iron, the dress Gerda smocked at night while the household slept. Then the pastel sweater Gerda knitted for her. The child sits on the edge of the bed while Gerda brushes, then twists the child's fair hair into two fat braids secured with rubber bands. The child, so much fairer than her parents, nearly believes she's Swedish, is pleased then and 40 years on to be taken for Scandinavian, Gerda's own. Now Gerda pulls up the white anklets, fastens the sandals, down to the pantry where the child climbs into her chair. Gerda sets three places, one for the child, one for the child's imaginary playmate, and one for her. And they eat the lovely oatmeal Gerda cooked the night before. 30 years on, her father will remark, "Your mother was jealous, so we let her go. Of course I could have raised her wages. Gerda ran the house." The child's throat fills with bile as casually he continues, "I always let your mother decide these matters." Smug, he often used that phrase, as if the abdication of his fatherhood had been a sacrifice. What did he know of the child's needs or passions? So Gerda left the house, the yard, the garden, the child's home, long torn down, a place that no longer exists. 35 years on, the child still stumbles among the weeds in search of the path down which her Gerda walked, or a trace of the porch where she once stood bereft. The child's 8th year, like Gerda, disappeared. Hazy recall of illness, asthma, the wheeze, the struggle for breath, and the louder rhythmic wheeze of oxygen. Of the weeks in bed, lying inert, nothing remains, only the pallid joys of recovery, jello and milk, ice cream 3 times. Is this a bribe? Dreamily sucking a spoonful of melting vanilla, only these splinters of a vanished year. It must have been then that the ice house dream began, her first and last recurring dream. The child stands in a little room of ice. Outside, a song begins, impossibly nostalgic, played on a concertina or harmonium. As the dream goes on, slowly, slowly the walls move in, the ceiling presses down till she is encased in a kind of upright coffin of milky, iridescent ice. Entranced by a vision of green hills and pure blue skies without, she conceives freedom and flight. She must memorize the tune as the ice moves in to touch her on every side and on her head. As the last haunting note is played, the child wakes up. Of course the tune is gone. It is always gone. For 10 years, the child nurtures a secret plan. At last, she boards a train for the East, waits for the layover in Minneapolis, hurries to a payphone, armed with change, opens the directory, faints to see 4 columns, closely printed, of Gerda Johnson's. How could there be more than one? Ranging her nickels on the metal counter, she calls from the top as the hands of the clock spin round. Gerda, Gerda, half a page with answers none, or ancient whispery Norse voices down a tunnel of years and oceans crossed and cold home villages abandoned long ago. Then she runs out of change and time, a train to catch. She weeps at terminated hope, nourished for so long, as the old film strip runs again. Gerda, you trudge down the walk forever. The child, no matter how she calls and cries, cannot catch up. Now from another life she summons you, out of the earth or ether, wherever you are. Gerda, come back to nurse your desolate child. If you applaud after every number, and you applaud less for one poem than another, I'll think you don't like it. All right, I promised I would read Parents Pan 2, which I will. My daughters hate this poem, by the way. One of them's polite about it, and the other one sits there shuddering and groaning. Where did these enormous children come from? More ladylike than we have ever been. Some of ours look older than we feel. How do they appear in their long dresses, more ladylike than we have ever been? But they moan about their aging more than we do. In their fragile heels and long black dresses, they say they admire our youthful spontaneity. They moan about their aging more than we do. A somber group, why don't they brighten up? Though they say they admire our youthful spontaneity, they beg us to be dignified like them, as they ignore our pleas to brighten up. Someday perhaps we'll capture their attention. Then we won't try to be dignified like them, nor they to be so gently patronizing. Someday perhaps we'll capture their attention. Don't they know that we're supposed to be the stars? Instead, they are so gently patronizing, it makes us feel like children, second childish. Perhaps we're too accustomed to be stars, the famous flowers glowing in the garden. So now we pout like children, second childish, quaint fragments of forgotten history. Our daughters stroll together in the garden, chatting of news we've chosen to ignore, pausing to toss us morsels of their history, not questions to which only we know answers. Eyes closed to news we've chosen to ignore. We'd rather excavate old memories, disdaining age, ignoring pain, avoiding mirrors. Why do they never listen to our stories? Because they hate to excavate old memories. They don't believe our stories have an end. They don't ask questions because they dread the answers. They don't see that we've become their mirrors, we offspring of our enormous children. This poem is called 12 O'Clock. In Berkeley a few years ago, the widow of the famous nuclear physicist E.O. Lawrence was trying to get his name taken off the Lawrence Livermore Lab, which is on the cutting edge of nuclear development. She was very beautiful and very old, and I wanted to write about her and about him. So I spent 2 years reading popular books on nuclear physics, which I knew nothing about. I think I barely passed general science way back then. And I want you to know that everything in this poem is absolutely true, and all the quotes are absolutely true. I have a wonderful memory for conversation, what people have said. It goes way back. I guess I wanted to make a distinction between my mother's and Einstein's idealistic version of an orderly universe and Heisenberg's and my feeling that the universe was anything but orderly. But I also want to get in the idea that, as Einstein believed, everything happened simultaneously, which was a lot of fun doing the poem. I had stanzas on the floor. I was walking around barefoot, picking them up and rearranging them and so on to try to get that effect. 12 o'clock. At 17, I've come to read a poem at Princeton. Now my young hosts inquire if I would like to meet Professor Einstein. But I'm too conscious I have nothing to say to interest him. The genius fled from Germany just in time.
Just tell me where I can look at him, I replied. Mother had scientific training. I did not. She loved that line of Meredith's about the army of unalterable law. God was made manifest to her in what she saw as the supreme order of the skies. We lay in the meadow side by side long summer nights as she named the stars with awe. But I saw nothing that was rank on rank, heard nothing of the music of the spheres. But in the bliss of meadow silences, lying on insects we had mashed without intent, found overhead a beautiful and terrifying mess. Especially in August, when the meteors whizzed and zoomed, echoed in little by the fireflies in the grass. Although a small hypocrite, I was seeming to assent. I was dead certain that uncertainty governed the universe and everything else, including Mother's temperament. A few years earlier, when I was 4, Mother and Father hushed before the Atwater Kent as a small voice making ugly noises through the static spoke from the grill, church window-shaped, to them. Listen, darling, and remember always, it's Dr. Einstein broadcasting from Switzerland. I said, so what? This was repeated as a witticism by my doting parents. I was dumb and mortified, so when I'm asked if I would like to speak to Einstein, I say I only want to look at him. Each day in the library, right at 12, Einstein comes out for lunch, so I am posted. At the precise stroke of 12, the noon sends one clear ray into the center aisle. He just appears, baggy-kneed, sockless, slippered, with a famous raveling gray sweater, clutching a jumble of papers in one hand, and in the other his brown sack of sandwiches. The ray halos his head, Blake's vision of God, unmuscular, serene, except for the electric hair. In that flicker of a second, our smiles meet, vast genius and vast ignorance conjoined. He fixed, I fluid, a complicit yet impersonal interest. He dematerialized, and I left content. It was December 6th, exactly when, just hours before the Japanese attack, the Office of Scientific R&D began its hugely expanded program of research into nuclear weaponry. Racing the Germans, who they feared were far ahead. In fact, they weren't. Next night, the coach to school, the train, express, instead pulls into every hamlet. Grim young men swarm the platform going to enlist. I see their faces in the sallow light as the train jolts, then starts up again, reaching Penn Station hours after midnight. At dinner in New York in 44, I hear the name of Heisenberg. Someone remarked, I wonder where he is, the most dangerous man alive. Heisenberg. I kept the name. Were the Germans still or the Russians yet a threat? Uncertainty. But I felt a thrill of apprehension. Genius struck again. It is the stroke of 12. And I suppose the ray that halos Einstein halos me. White blonde hair to my waist, almost 6 feet tall, in my best and only suit. Why cavil? I am beautiful. We smile, but it has taken all these years to realize that when I looked at Einstein, he saw me. At last that May, when Germany collapsed, the British kidnapped Heisenberg from France, where he and colleagues sat in a special transit camp named Dustbin to save them from a threat they never knew. A mad American general thought to solve the post-war nuclear problem by having them all shot. Some boys in pristine uniform crowd the car, West Pointers fleeing from a weekend dance, youth's ambiguities resolved in a single action. I still see their faces in the yellow light as the train jolts, then starts up again, so many destined never to be men. In Cambridge, the Germans visited old friends, kept apart by war, Austrians, English, Danes, in a happy reunion at Farm Hall. But then, the giant fist struck in the still center of chaos, noise unimaginable. We thought we heard the awful cry of God. Hiroshima. Heisenberg at first refused to believe it till the evening news confirmed that their work had led to Hiroshima's 100,000 dead. Worst hit of us all, said Heisenberg, was Otto Hahn, who discovered uranium fission. Hahn withdrew to his room, and we feared that he might do himself some harm. It is exactly noon, and Dr. Einstein is an ancient drawing of the sun. Simple as a saint emerging from his cell, dazed by his own light. I think of Giotto, Chaucer, all good and moral medieval men, in yet removed from their historic time. The week before we heard of Heisenberg, my parents and I are chatting on the train from Washington. A gray-haired, handsome man listens with open interest, then inquires if he might join us. We are such a fascinating family. Oh, yes, we chorus, sit with us. Penn Station, near at hand, we asked his name. E.O. Lawrence, he replied, and produced his card. I'd never heard of him, but on an impulse asked, what is all this about the harnessing of the sun's rays? Should we be frightened? He smiled. My dear, there's nothing in it. So reassured, we said goodbyes and spoke of him in coming years, that lovely man. Of course, we found out who he was and what he did, at least as much as we could comprehend. Now I am living in the Berkeley Hills, in walking distance of the Lawrence Lab. Here, where Dr. Lawrence built the cyclotron, it's noon, the anniversary of Hiroshima. Everywhere, all over Japan and Germany, people are lighting candles. It's dark in Germany and Japan on different days. But here in Berkeley, it is 12 o'clock. I stand in the center of the library, and he appears. Are we witnesses or actors? The old man and the girl smiling at one another, he fixed by fame, she still without identity, an instant which changes nothing and everything forever. Everything is changed. Now I'll read a couple of new poems. Somebody mentioned dactylic hexameters, which is a wonderful meter for writing social criticism, and that's what Juvenal and Catullus did. And it's very rarely used, and I loved it. This is just a silly poem, but I love it. Union of Women. At a literary gathering in Santa Monica, I encounter a bearded lady wearing a union button. We engage each other in friendly conversation. When I was a little girl in Spokane, Washington, I took enormous satisfaction in the label sewn to my clothes by the Ladies' Garment Workers Union. I was contributing to the wealth of women as I chose my dresses. Oh, solidarity. Oh, feminism. Much later, I met a Ladies' Garment Workers Union leader who told me she was the only woman who had ever been an official in that union, always ignored, outvoted. I felt retrospectively cheated. Now, my new friend, the one with the white beard, she won't mind if I mention it. She wrote a cinquain about it. Says that her local, 814, mostly women, engages in struggle with the terrible Sheraton, its unfair labor practices concerning the ladies who change the beds and mop the bathrooms and fold the ends of the toilet paper in those stupid triangles and put the mints on the pillow. Of course, they're all blacks, I mean African-American, or Mexicans who hardly speak English and fear deportation. It's clear my bearded friend, though old and lame, is a fighter. And she writes excellent cinquains. She just sent me a bunch. You know what a cinquain is? A nifty form in five lines adopted by Crapsey from the medieval French. She, as the current jargon would have it, made my day. So here's to solidarity, cinquains, brave bearded ladies. Hooray. And I'll end with this one. My latest poem called The Ashes. This elderly poet, unpublished for 5 decades, said that one day in her village, a young girl came screaming down the road, "The Red Guards are coming! The Red Guards are coming!" At once, the poet ran into her house and stuffed the manuscript of her poems into the stove, her only copy. When the guards arrived, they took her into the yard for interrogation. As they spoke, the poet's mother tried to hang herself in the kitchen. That's all I know about the Red Guard. It is enough. The elderly poet is bitter, and why not? She earned her PhD at an Ivy League school and returned to China in 1948. Bad timing. She is bitter with me because I've chosen to translate a younger poet, young enough to be her child or mine. The truth is, her poems are pedestrian, uninspired. She knows this. She wants me to recompose them from the ashes. She wants the noose around her mother's neck untied by me. She wants, oh, she wants to have her whole life over. Not to leave America in 1948. To know me when we are both young, promising poets. Her rusty English now is flawless. My Mandarin, so long unused, is fluent. No dictionaries needed. A perfect confidence flowing between us. And the Red Guard saves the red sword lilies that invigilate the garden, unimagined by us both. I, who believe the Reds are agrarian reformers, she who believes she will be an honored poet, her name known to everyone, safe in her fame. Thank you.